Good day, nerds, and welcome to episode 106 of the Nerd Cantina Show. And today we've got another Cantina conversation with our book reviewer Megan McCarthy Bianc and Annie Sullivan. Annie Sullivan is the author of A Touch of Gold and most recently A Curse of Gold, which is set to release here on September 22nd. In this interview, Megan and Annie discuss how Annie turned a piece of Greek mythology and a fable that we all know, the story of King Midas and the Midas touch, and flipped this story around into a very interesting set of novels here. It seems like Megan and Annie had a great time during this interview, and I think you will enjoy. So stick around and take a listen.
We are here with Annie Sullivan, author of A Curse of Gold, which is releasing September 22nd. That's the sequel that completes the duology of A Touch of Gold. Okay, and so thank you so much, Annie, for taking the time to talk with us today, offer our readers and our listeners like a little something extra to dive in as you kind of, you know, get excited and get into the final stretch here for, you know, promoting your sequel. It's very exciting, even though it's kind of a weird time right now. So we appreciate you, taking the time to talk with us and adding a little something extra for us to get excited.
I'm excited to be here and to talk with you guys and talk all things books and writing and all that good stuff.
And oh yeah, we love it. No, I'm a huge bookworm, so I'm here for it. Okay, so let's start off with like going into your background, you know, in terms of like, you know, professional and personal and how you kind of like led up to this idea of, you know, twisting an old like Greek mythology favorite, or maybe well-known or maybe not so well-known story up on its head and kind of taking it in another direction that way.
Yeah. Well, I definitely started out as a kid. I loved Greek mythology. My mom would show us all these Greek mythology movies, you know, Jason and the Argonauts and all that good stuff. And I also loved writing as a kid. I would write these silly little stories. But then I ended up actually getting a master's degree in creative writing from Butler University. So that's kind of my background. And from there, I wrote my first book, which was A Touch of Gold. And I really wanted to dive into this idea of these twisted kind of fractured fairy tales. You know, so often we see the same fairy tales again and again, which I mean, I still love. I love it, obviously. But I really wanted to think about, you know, the forgotten characters in the King Midas myth. And, you know, that's his daughter, because in the original myth, she's just a means to an end. She's just there so that her father learns that it was a bad idea to ask to turn things to gold because he turns his daughter to gold. So in my version, she's been turned back from a golden statue into a living, breathing human being. But she has some lasting side effects. So it was really about exploring that whole idea.
I thought it was really unique. And of course, I love hearing about stories that kind of, you know, give the female character kind of like, wait a second, like, you know, what if she had some sort of agency, or what if we could tap into her mind of, you know, cause she was unfortunately a consequence of his, you know, but I liked kind of how you, because he wasn't totally selfish. I guess maybe in the Greek mythology, the story, there's a couple of different versions of his story, but he kind of comes off as like just greedy. But, you know, in the story, you kind of gave him a little more like sympathy. Like he was doing it, even though, you know, obviously like he was doing it to help his country during a hard time. But even, you know, not everybody, that will happen in real life anyway. Like, you know, people don't really realize the whole story, or they hear rumors, or they just kind of assume things and like, oh, he was greedy. And it's like, no, well, he made a bad call and he did get tricked essentially. And unfortunately his daughter, you know, had to take the brunt of that. And she was very unlucky. So I really liked how you kind of gave, you know, let us kind of, you know, get you imagine how it might be, how her story might be, how she might be feeling, how she might be dealing with all of this. And so that kind of like, so I have a couple questions about that. Like, so in tapping into Cora and her character and kind of creating what her life would be like, what was like maybe the more challenging parts, or what kind of research or any, like what kind of stuff did you have to like tap into, to like enter the mind of someone who grew up in like, isolation or the subject of rumors, because the whole kingdom thinks like, you know, oh, she's made of gold and she turns everything to gold, or they have like all these crazy rumors about her. And so, and because people like whisper about her or are kind of afraid of her, she doesn't have a whole lot of human connection. And so she's kind of isolated. So kind of like how did you get yourself in that headspace of like having to imagine a life like that?
Yeah. I mean, I think it's definitely something that as a writer, you have to do, you have to really enter that character's mind. And mm-hmm. so for me, you know, it was tapping into every experience I had as a child. You know, was I bullied? Was I, you know, were there rumors about me? And sure. in essence, you know, Cora basically has anxiety about, yeah. like, about touching or being near gold because of the things that have happened in her past. And so I have a lot of anxiety myself. And so that was kind of an easy thing to kind of tap into right there. And almost I'm a little bit of a germaphobe as well. So like not wanting to like touch things, great time to be a germaphobe, guys.
Right.
No, but her not wanting to touch things, that also kind of comes from me. So in some ways it is a lot of me, but in other ways, you know, it was researching all, like you said, the different versions of the myth and the different reasonings behind why King Midas had his power and all those kind of things to kind of compile it into one cohesive story with a strong backstory where you can relate to Princess Cora after she's been turned to gold, as well as to her father, and just explore mm-hmm. the relationship. I mean, because if you get turned to gold by your father, like... Mm-hmm. that's going to be a little kind of a dicey relationship to navigate. Like,
yeah, especially after him just embracing her, like at such a yeah. young age too, as a child. And, you know, if he'd be if for the rest of his life, he's like afraid to go near her. He's just, and mm-hmm. her hair and her skin is just a constant reminder of the mistake that he made. And then he, you know, he kind of had a chance to like make it right, but then he screwed that up too. Yeah, that's such a complicated relationship to kind of navigate. And no, I really appreciate you being honest about having anxiety, because I think a lot of people, you know, maybe that's not something that they always want to like present to the world or kind of be mm-hmm. honest about. And even if they're honest with themselves, I understand if maybe that's not a subject matter that comes up in casual conversation.
Right.
And, yeah. And so no, and I imagine that even during this crazy time, you know, because I don't think like the printing and the editing necessarily lined up with the whole pandemic. Because I think you probably had all of this written out before the world went on fire. Right?
Yes.
And so things like kind of got turned on its head. But I think there's a lot of people who are kind of, you know, dealing with either that for the first time, or they're like, you know, they've been honest with themselves about it for a while. And so they get it by now. And then mm-hmm. this is like, it's still a challenge, but they're kind of like seasoned with their mental health already. And so, I appreciate you kind of being honest with a like, yeah. no, straight up, like it wasn't that hard to get in your brain, because I am in my brain. And I totally get it. And it's, you know, it's a way for you to cope too, probably. And I think it's a way for your readers to kind of relate, you know, cause yeah, it was like, you can, you know, before we're going to try to be spoiler free this podcast, but you know, and well, in book one, maybe it's not so spoiler, so much of a spoiler. But you know, because it's later revealed why she gets so much anxiety around gold. And then mm-hmm. it's because she wasn't sure. And then she eventually learns she could use it to her advantage. So I thought that it was really cool how you kind of helped her to discover how to use it to empower her.
Yeah. And that's one of my big things. Yeah. As a writer, is to really present characters who, you know, like we said, she has rumors about her. She's been bullied. She's isolated. To present these characters that the kids today might feel like, you know, they might have rumors about them in school. They might be getting bullied on or offline. And I want them to be able to go into a fun fantasy world and say, hey, that character is a little bit like me. Mm-hmm. And you know what? They came out of it stronger. The things that they thought were weaknesses about themselves turned out to be their biggest strengths.
Right.
And so I want each, you know, each kid, each reader out there to kind of say, like, maybe something that I see as a flaw is actually something that makes me really unique and special. You know, that can definitely be the case.
Exactly. And I think that's, you know, that's so important. I think just, you know, especially for this age group with young adults, I think it's really important, because it's so, even like I'm in my early 30s and it's so easy to be insecure about anything.
I'm with you there.
Yeah. It's like things that like, you know, you're probably the only person that notices it about yourself. And so, you know, obviously Cora's situation is like, no, everybody notices it and it's different. It's strange to them and they have no idea really the truth behind it. And she also because they're in such like an exposed environment as like a king and princess. It's like, you know, they're in plain sight like all the time. Like they have such an open, like accessible life almost. And it's, so it was just so difficult to like not only deal with, you know, being the princess, but also deal with, you know, how do we hide the truth? And if people find out, you know, that her father is like straight up dependent on these items, and, you know, but nobody can know why, nobody can know how. Okay. But the first book she has to go, so, cause somebody steals them, she has to go find them. And then she still has to keep that a secret somehow. And yeah. In addition to dealing with venturing out on her own. And that's why I liked, you know, with book one, she's like, you can tell she's shy and timid, and she's kind of like self, you know, there's a lot of self doubt. There's a lot of, you know, her being like, you know, in her head, kind of like having to pretend. And then, but she's also new to the world in terms of like dealing with people. Like she doesn't have a whole lot of experience interacting with others. And so I thought it was like really interesting how not only you kind of like, you know, you, I feel like a lot of her reaction to the world and to the like navigating new relationships with people, especially like with a crew of pirates, essentially, after being raised, like isolated in a castle or a palace, it's like, it was such a almost like a culture shock to her, but I think anything would have been a culture shock at that point because she had it.
I think she was so protected that, but going out with a whole bunch of pirates and seafaring adventure, you know, it was definitely a big thing for her, but it was a lot of fun to write.
Yeah, no, I imagine. So like, what was it difficult writing from the point of view of a teenager?
No, I mean, that's what I love to read. So that's what I love to write. And I just kind of, that's where I just naturally fit, you know, I've dabbled in picture books, like thought about writing some of those. But yeah, young adult is just what I love, and especially fantasy, because, you know, I mean, in the real, like in, you know, if you're writing contemporary, there's so many things you have to like deal with, like cell phones and technology and all that kind of stuff, which can get really crazy. But in fantasy, like anything's up for grabs. And
That's so true. Like the world is your oyster kind of thing. As long as you're consistent, right?
Yes, exactly. And that's why magic is such an important thing in this book. And you have to make sure that all the magical rules align and are, you know, correct and work together. So.
No, I know. Cause I do a lot of reading for, you know, the book reviews and the podcasts and stuff. And it's funny to like, just to kind of like talk to authors who are just like, well, my editor had to point this out to me or like, you know, we had to figure out the physics of this and that. And then it's like, oh no. Yeah. Like you kind of almost have to like, even if it takes post-it notes like around, or cause I imagine you have a different, like some authors, I know that they outline, some maybe they don't outline and they wish they did eventually. But no, I just think that's one of like the funniest parts about creating a world, and it allows you to like really go for it, but then you have to, you know, be consistent or else.
Yes.
Yeah. Or else like really, really, you know, really meticulous readers are going to be like, wait a second. And then.
Right. Yeah. People will point out those mistakes, and I'm a pantser. So I fly by the seat of my pants. I don't plot things out.
Oh, okay.
So, which is always fun and difficult at the same time. Cause I'm like, well, what happens next? And I'm like, well, what does happen next? You're the only one who's going to figure that out.
Exactly. So. I know. And it goes back to like, well, you're like the god of their world. And then, you know, it goes to like, oh yeah. So that's also reminds me of one of my other questions, actually. Like I guess it's a 2-part question. What was the most difficult scene for you to write? And then what was like, or scenes, and you know, on A Curse of Gold, maybe try to be spoiler free, but yeah. And then also like, what were your favorite parts to write as well?
Oh, I think some of the hardest ones to write actually was the beginning, because that's when things kind of really go south very quickly. Mm. And people kind of start to turn on Cora a little bit because, you know, again, she's still cursed. So that's a little hard. But I think my favorite scene, there's a scene where they end up on an island with some mythological creatures that I really love, because I love to take Greek mythology and present it very much the same as the original myth, but with a twist. Like you think you know what you're getting, and then there's just a little oomph, a little surprise. So that's what I love to do. So I think that was probably one of my favorite scenes, is girl who can turn things to gold ends up on an island with some very powerful magic.
Yes. Yes. Yeah, that was definitely, it was like, and that last like quarter of the book was really, it was pretty action packed too. Cause it's like, I remember reading it and it was like one part, it was like, okay, then now they're going to go, they're going to finally get to the end point. Oh, nope. There's something else. No, they can't catch a break. It's like, they're constantly running. And then, you know, poor Cora is dealing with her own stuff that yes. she has to keep secret. And it's like, oh my gosh, poor woman. Like,
I always say you should like throw the worst possible things at your characters. And I'm like, well, sorry yeah. guys.
Like nobody's going to stop me. So
Right. Where's my editor when I need her? That's right. What my characters are saying. They're like, we give up. No.
I know, right? It's like, okay, well, this is what I'm doing. And if they don't like it, kind of like, they'll tell you, right? Like they tell you if they don't, or if they think, no, this is, can you give her a break? It's like, well, no, like I'm not. But actually, no, I enjoyed it.
We did go through a couple different, I did have to plot some of the second one for them, you know, in order to like have them buy it. I was like, okay, here's the plot.
Oh, right.
It's really hard because as a panster, I was like, I don't know what happens until I read it. So we went back and forth on a couple different outlines to be like, okay, this is the perfect kind of like sequence. So yeah.
So was that like a major challenge for you then to have to really like kind of lay it, like literally lay it out on paper? So that was that probably like the more challenging part of your writing
yeah.
process of having to like kind of sell, you have to sell it as a package deal essentially, right? And then
exactly
have to have
yeah.
a plan
and they
laid out.
Want to see yeah all those kind of details about what you've got planned, and you have to sit there and be like, well, and I mean that's the thing that I love about being a panster is I discover what's going to happen as the reader discovers it. And so that makes it really exciting for me because I'm like, I don't know what's going to happen. And I'm on the edge of my seat. And if I'm on the edge of my seat, hopefully the reader is as well. But with an outline, I'm like, well, I guess this could happen. And then this could happen. Like it takes a little bit of the fun out of it. So it is a little harder for me to do outlines, but in the end it was worth it. So.
Yeah, no, I would say so. And then, so do you think like for any future projects that you will outline from now on?
Ugh, no.
Unless they make you do it again, maybe.
I know. Unless they like make me, and then I'll be like, all right. Well, the funny thing is I know tons of authors who will turn in an outline and then turn in a book that's nothing like the outline.
Right.
So you're
that's
like,
how it happens, I guess. That's how it happens sometimes where you know you get into it, and once you get in the zone and you really start fleshing it out, it just turns into something, you know, the story might take a mind of its own where it just makes so much sense to do it that way. And then,
right.
Yeah. And then who, you know, that's funny because then the editors, the publishers are like, wait a second.
You're like, this isn't what you gave us. And I'm like, is it not?
Right. Are you sure? Are you sworn?
You're like, just read it. You'll like it. I promise.
Right. You're like, no, trust me. This is the best.
Right.
So Hetty was pretty awesome. She was pretty interesting. And I'm thinking, cause I'm going back to like Cora's character growth. Was it always a plan for you to have her stow away kind of and you know, kind of piggyback and tag along on Cora's adventure? Or kind of was it like, because I see Hetty as like kind of important for Cora's growth as well.
Mm-hmm. She actually didn't show up, though. Not too much of a spoiler, but, you know, she tags along. Mm-hmm. And I'm a fanster. I didn't know she showed up until they opened the door and boom, there she was. And I was like, oh, sweet, she's coming. But no, I mean, the draft did go through quite a few different kind of versions. And I think originally she had a maid who was like her friend.
Okay.
That just didn't cut it. So I was like, what if, you know, we've got this cousin, Hetty, what if she came along, you know, kind of mm-hmm. like, oh, let's try it. So... And it ended up being such a great decision. I loved having it.
Yeah, I think I definitely think it was a good decision too, because she just couldn't be any more different than Cora. But I think she was like, not only did she kind of compliment her personality traits, but she also, Hetty goes through some character growth as well too. And, yes. You know, whether or not she wanted to, but.
Mm-hmm. Especially in the second book, she gets a lot of.
Absolutely. And because she just, you know, after the events of the first book, Hetty's just like, she's mad. And then once you kind of like, because yeah, because I think like, okay, we're in Korra's head this whole time. This is Korra's story. And then it's like really good. It's really great to see how in the second book, she kind of uses her experience from the first book where she was like, she put herself in danger and she got betrayed multiple times and straight up like, she's taking that with her, and you can kind of sense it, like her mood and the vibe of the second book where she's just like, no, this is my place. Like I'm the princess. I'm the heir. I'm the future ruler. This is my people. This is my land. This is my people. And she kind of embraces that role. Whereas before in book one, she was like, how am I going to do this? But now even in the second book, she's still kind of like, how am I going to do this? But she's like, well, I have to figure it out. So I have to do this.
Yeah.
And so I thought that was like, you know, I love character growth, and I love like, you know, how, you know, connecting the dots of like the stuff that she went through in the first book, and it helped her propel her, and she had more confidence and, you know, more comfort with those around her. But then also I think Hedy was just like such an important part of that. And she gave her a little nudge in the first book. And then the second book, it's like still, now there's a like extra layer because it's from the complications of the first book with, you know, people start, the rumors starting about Hedy,
mm-hmm.
you know, now Hedy's kind of isolated almost, but you know, cause she doesn't know. She's also just kind of stubborn and she's like, yeah. Well, you gotta screw everything. I'm doing what I want. And it's almost like and especially when they finally like have a heart to heart and they become honest with each other too, it's almost a little heartbreaking. It's like a tender moment, but it's almost a little heartbreaking too, because you're just like, there was such a misunderstanding between them,
mm-hmm.
because it you did a good job of kind of showing not only like the conflict within Korra's own brain, but then also, you know, how much she like wants to make that connection with other people, especially with her closest people, with her family. And then it all comes down to like her unfortunate circumstances. That's kind of just getting in the way. And I think that's just, I mean, that you could find that in real life too, but it's so crazy. It's like, well, no, it's because I have golden skin and golden hair and my dad did this to me and he doesn't know how to treat me now. And then now, you know, oh, my cousin she doesn't know how to approach me about it either. And it's like, where do you go from there? And then, you know, Hedy just shows up. And then in the second book, she's like, yeah, well, what? She's like, no, like, I'm fine. She's just like, I'm fine. Like, leave me alone. I'm fine. I got this. And then, it's just, I appreciated her character growth too, even if it seemed to like, I don't want to say she pedaled back, but I think she was doing a lot of work to just kind of like stay afloat or keep up. But
yeah, I think she goes through a lot after the first book. And that, again, it's all about, you know, relationships and how things work and things that are said and left unsaid and, you know, things that you get to deal with and sometimes you don't get to deal with or face. Mm-hmm. So yeah, I really wanted to bring that to the forefront for her character and kind of examine that, you know, and see how that would affect her. Cause I love to have a very strong supporting cast of side characters who feel so real and each have their own kind of weighty backstory that maybe you don't get to see, but you get to see glimpses of it, you know?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So you feel like these people are real.
Yeah, and no, it's, you know, after having reading a story told in first person, it's nice to have interesting characters who are like, you know, I remember just reading and I'm like, well, what's her problem or what's his problem? This guy's kind of weird. Like, oh, I'm going to stay away from him. But then I think with the twins was like,
oh, yeah.
The introduction of the twins, they were like, they seemed kind of shady, but then you like, you know, but it's, you're living in Korra's brain. So
everyone seems a little shady to Korra when he compares me. And she's like, who are you? I don't.
Yeah.
And it's, you know, like, but if you're a girl with golden skin, you got to be careful, you know, because you don't know what people are after.
Exactly. And that was like one of the more complications of her character as well. Cause she didn't know who to trust. She didn't know, like she was made of, people thought she was made of gold and they thought that she could turn things to gold. And it was like, of course, like, you know, there are people out there who would want that power, who would want to take advantage of that and who would, you know, go to extreme lengths to have that power. And like, she was no stranger to that. But yeah, it was like, she had her guard up and then But then she kind of, you know, that's where the first book, like, she had something. She was the only person who could help her father. So she had no choice. And then this second one, with the second book, you know, with her, she goes on another journey, and it's, she see, you know, I think I was like touching on this before, where she's kind of like, no, I have to figure it out. It has to be me. Even though she kind of had that attitude in the first one, but she was more like in the second book, she was like, you could tell she was like, she was embracing her role, and she still like knew, like she knew better. She knew she couldn't always like trust everybody, but at least she knew like the original people that she was with, her crew, she didn't have any doubts about them anymore, like at all.
Which is, it's so nice to be able to trust people, you know, and that's what any relationship is built on, is trust. And I think that's what she learned in the first book, you know, more with her father. And, you know, like she said, with her crew, you know, she learned to trust these people. And that's what helped open her up a little bit and help her become the strong character that she needed to be.
Yeah, absolutely. And no, I think, you know, I think about the stuff that, like, you know, she was thrown into this unfamiliar situation where she kind of had no choice but to figure it out. And it's when you are the only person that can do this, like you, and when you have no choice, then I think, you know, it's, you come out better for it. Like, we, you know, you, she grew with this confidence, and I'm like thinking like, yeah, I've been put in situations where I've just had to figure it out on the fly, and I ended up that much more confident. I ended up that much more like, you know, sure of myself, you know? Mm-hmm. And so, no, I appreciate seeing that in characters. I think she's really, you know, even though she's made of gold and skin and hair, I think she, I think she's still relatable. You did a good job of making a character who, unfortunately, you know, her appearance, like, it's not like some magic power that, you know, she can hide it. Like, mm-hmm. you know, it's almost like if you're thinking about X-Men, there are some mutants where you can't tell that they have powers, but there are some that are like, no, straight up, it's very physical.
Yeah.
You know, someone like Nightcrawler with blue skin or mm-hmm. like in a tail, and you know, it's she's ousted no matter what, unless she like is dressed from head to toe and with everything. And so that, you know, she doesn't even have that luxury of like hiding it really.
Exactly. And so that, I mean, that's what she did in her palace, is she hid behind veils and gloves and things. So then outside in the outside world, you can't do that. And so it is, you know, in some ways it is. It's taking the gloves off and going out there and facing it and saying, okay, I have to do this. It has to be me. And accepting the challenge of facing it, whether you're going to succeed or not. And I hope that's, you know, again, another message that readers take away is that, like, go for it. You get one chance, you know?
Exactly. So. You know, hopefully the consequences wouldn't be that drastic.
Yeah, I definitely hope so. But if you need help saving a kingdom, call on some young adult authors.
Right.
We've done it many times, guys. We're here for you.
The stakes aren't that high, okay? You guys got this. Like, it's okay.
Yes, yes. Maybe it's finishing your homework or something, but you can do it, whatever it is.
Right. Or it's like, you know, just ask the guy out. Just ask the girl out.
Yeah. Or speak up with them if that's the problem too.
Right. Like,
like, you know, you get one chance, guys. Be brave. Be bold.
And it's, so that's what I think about, like, you know, older readers, you know, they, it's easy to become so attached and look back and think, it's like, oh my God, what's the big deal? Like, just do it. But, you know, it's easy for us to say because we know better by now. But yeah, when you're that age, you're just like, you know, you're absorbing the world and you're making these choices that the more important, you know, then you see a cute boy and you get so distracted, or a cute girl, and it's so easy to be like, you know, with the unconventional love triangle that you snuck into this book, like, in the first book anyway, the second book, you know, we're all good to go, but no, the first book, it's like, yeah, of course, you know, she's kind of skeptical, but then it's like, of course she is, because she's had all these suitors come, and they eventually, she sees it coming, and then this, you know, she's trying to, like, gear up for her responsibilities, and then it's like, oh, this cute, charming man comes along. Oh, he happens to have a ship that can help me on my quest. Like,
how convenient. No.
Yeah, exactly. And so, okay, so what kind of, like, with the second book, there's a lot of more creativity in terms of, like, you know, you go ahead more heavy into the Greek mythology mm-hmm. and the creatures and all that stuff, and then also coming up with, like, kind of the riddles that Korra has to figure out. So, like, was that I know you said you're like a pantser, like you kind of like usually figure it out as you go, but like, so how were those some of the details that you kind of knew that you wanted to fit in, or was it because like it's so much more drastic in terms of like compared to book one versus like book two has like is heavier in the Greek mythology?
Well, I think one reason that it's heavier in the Greek mythology is because when I turn in those outlines I mentioned earlier, we end up on a couple different islands. I don't want to give too much away. And my editor was like, I really love that they end up on this one island, but I don't want them to take a boat to get there because we took a boat in the last book. And so I was like, wait, I can't take two boats. They're like,
oh, no.
So I was like, you want them to go to an island and not take a boat. Got it.
Oh my gosh.
A lot of it was just being very creative to kind of solve that problem. But in the end, it worked out so much better.
I did.
Because there was, and again, a lot of that Greek mythology, it exists. Like I took what's already there and then just magnified it a little bit.
Right. You kind of manipulated it to how it would fit into Korra's adventure.
Exactly. How it could add a little bit more danger and make things worse for them.
That is so funny. So basically, that's like kind of a big challenge.
Yeah.
Writing prompt, if you want to call it.
Like,
imagine that your main character has to accomplish this, but they don't have any of the tools that would make sense.
Right. You cannot take this way to get there. You have to find a different way. So I was like, all right, I'll find a different way. So then I just was like, oh, well, these couple things over here work. So.
Right. Oh, that's so funny. That's so interesting. Cause that's why I like wonder if, cause that's definitely one thing I noticed was that book one was mostly about like Korra and her dad and her trying to figure it out and us like getting, and her accomplishing this one quest. And there's like some Greek stuff dabbled in there with some of the stuff that she has to do. But then the second book, it's like really like, no, like this is, on a scale, like magnified. And it was really cool. And trying to be spoiler free, we get to meet some more important characters and, that were kind of just mentioned in book one, and in book two, we kind of actually get to like approach them and meet them. And it's like,
We actually almost took out all the Greek mythology stuff in the first book. That was something one of the editors mentioned, was like, why don't we just make it like not Greek? And I was like, no, because there are some things coming up in the sequel that it's going to depend on. So, so we definitely kept those in. So those little mentions were just kind of little teasers in the first
book. Like foreshadowing, or at least and you did bring a couple back into book two that were like little nice surprises stuff that she had to deal with in book one, and then these certain characters show up in book two and it was like but it was so funny because it's like comparing book one Korra to book two Korra.
Yes, that was a big thing. That was probably the hardest thing, is to making sure she didn't revert back to like shy Violet, who's like scared of the world. She had to like keep growing and growing and growing and becoming that leader that her people needed her to become.
Exactly. No, and that's, that's kind of the point, right? Of any story, of telling anybody's story, you want them to grow, and you want the reader to be able to like feel something for them. And be able to not necessarily to relate, but even just to be like, oh crap, how is she going to get out of this? Or how are they going to, and then you grow attached to other like secondary characters and you're just like, oh no, like, and it's, I don't know. By now I've known better than to become too attached to any characters, because you never know. And I just like, I'll kind of predict like, oh, this person's done for, we're not going to see this person again. And then it's like, oh, yay. Like they made it. This is great. And so, you didn't break too many people's hearts, I don't think, but, the second book a little, but you kind of foreshadow it a little bit in the second book with, some of the encounters that Korra has and stuff that she has to figure out. And then it's kind of like, and then you're kind of hope that me as a reader, I was kind of hoping, my predictions weren't going to be correct. and then they weren't, but then it was like the actual outcome. I was like, oh no, like, I was still kind of like brokenhearted a little bit. So,
I know. Yeah. My mom cries every time she reads it. Like she reads a draft of it, she gets to the end, she cries.
And she's
like,
no, what could be done? You're just like, okay, mom, don't just, you know, you're just doing that. Like, that's funny. It's like, you know, your parents are so supportive, but then it's like, no, okay, like chill. Like you yes. be, you know, it's like, I know you're supportive, but you can give me constructive criticism too. It's okay.
Right, I have to go overboard. Right. My mom's really good at grammar. My mom's a good grammar reader. She can read through that kind of stuff.
Oh, that's good.
Yeah.
Because you got your master's in creative writing. So that was probably like, a lot of that stuff probably comes second nature to you, but then she probably, because I imagine when you're writing prose, like it can just be so, you know, you got like one set of eyes on it and, mm-hmm. you know, you kind of get winded and then you don't always, so I guess like some authors might just want to get a draft out and then say goodbye to it and then pass it along and then come back mm-hmm. to it later. Depending on like how many deadlines you have to meet, you know?
Yeah.
But so I don't know. It's good that if like, did you pull your mom into the process then? If to just like,
oh yeah, actually my sister too. My sister is usually my first reader cause she will be very constructive, in the best possible way. No, she will definitely be very honest, which is nice. So she and my mom will kind of usually be my first readers, which everyone's like, don't have your family read it, but they catch all my silly mistakes. You know, if I say someone has like green eyes here and then later they have blue eyes, they're like, pick one.
You're right.
he took off his jacket but now he's wearing it, like little things like that. They'll find, so that's good. And then I'll usually send it to my agent to read, and then she'll look over it, and then I'll make some changes, maybe send it to a different critique partner.
That's good, because it's like, you know, that's a good point where it's like, oh, maybe you shouldn't let your family read it, but it's like in this case your family has some credibility, so it's, you know, they're not going to necessarily make it worse, because then I think your editor is going to be the people who are like, well, the plot or, you know, something more like a little more depth, or how you said, oh, how about you get them here without a boat?
Right?
Yeah.
I love that, but no boat.
that's so crazy. That's so funny. But it ended up being like a really important part of the puzzle, because then you had another opportunity to add some really cool stuff in there too.
So it was a lot of fun. It worked out really well.
Exactly. Like sure, get rid of it.
Right.
So something I did want to touch upon before we wrap up is so Cora's mom, Cora touches on her every once in a while, and she remembers her mom, but she essentially she grew up with a single dad. Mm-hmm. And unfortunately it was a dad that was afraid to interact with her or wasn't, you know, secure enough to overcome that fear or that insecurity. And, you know, that was really challenging for her. But so I wonder, like, did you think about keeping her mom in the picture at all? Like, when, you know, how did that come about, of where you decided to kind of focus on just that father-daughter relationship?
I think the first thing that I thought of was, like, you know, in the original myth the mom's not really mentioned at all, so
right.
I was like, okay, so let's start with that and see what happens. I did a couple times think about putting the mom in there, because it's such like a Disney stereotype to just have like either no parents or one parent or something. I was like, man, do I really want to fall into that category? Like, do that? But it just seemed to work out really well, because I think if you had a mom in the picture, I think it would have been an entirely different story. You know, either she would have been, you know, a peacemaker between the two, and, you know, just, you know, things would have worked out real quick if mom was around. Or, you know, mom may have, you know, seen her husband as a monster, you know, or seen her daughter as a monster. Oh, you were turned to gold. Like, so there's so many different ways that story could have gone if the mom was involved. And so I kind of liked the idea of making them just the dad and the daughter because of their relationship or lack thereof in many ways. I thought that was going to play into it better than if there was a mom around who would, make things a lot easier in some ways. So
yeah, that's a good point, where it's like, for the fact, you know, for the purpose of the plot and the story, mm-hmm. like, you can't make things too easy for them.
as we've covered, clearly I just throw problem after problem.
Yeah, right.
I did feel that one too.
It's so. Like, oh, she doesn't look like anybody else. Let's just like not, you know, let's just like make her stuck with this scenario and, you know, that she can do,
right? I need to write a new fairy tale with both parents alive, like, and be like, look, it can be done. Like,
yeah, no, and then that's so that was like my last question, because do I be respectful of your time, and you know, we otherwise I feel like I just ramble on about everything. So,
I'm there with you.
You're right. So do you, kind of touching upon that, do you have any plans for future projects?
I'm working on some new stuff. Nothing that I can quite talk about yet, because it's just in the early. I'm only like halfway through a draft of something. Mm. But it would be a new standalone, not a fairy tale.
Okay.
Although I am noticing now that there is at least one parent dead. So,
okay.
Sorry guys. Just how it's going to be. I mean, I could add another parent, but I don't know. We'll see.
That's okay. I mean, that's, you know, it might be a common, you know, scenario for a reason. So
yeah. Yeah. I think it'll be interesting. We'll see. It's going so slowly. I think with quarantine, it's hard to write sometimes because I'm just stuck at home all the time. So then there's like no separation between day job and trying to write. So
yeah, it's hard to get in the zone for sure. Even for like, I was working at home for a while and then unfortunately mm-hmm. I got laid off, but I got a new job. Ooh, but then it's okay. Like, yeah, it was a moment. Yeah. And then, but now it's, you know, I'm going on site and I, you know, I'm working part-time from home, but it's still like, you know, my husband is at home working full-time from home. And I, you know, it's almost like you kind of have, it's hard to get in the zone, like how you are in the office or in a different scenario. It's like either, mm-hmm. you know, or you're living at work almost. And it's,
yes.
and you don't want to get trapped into working around the clock. And I think even like all the stuff that I'm reading about, you know, cause I think it's just so interesting. Like one of the positives about being quarantined and what kind of, like, yeah, like it's as corny as it sounds, like, yes, we are all in this together. And I think mm-hmm. a lot of people are being forced to confront their mental health in ways that they've never had to before.
Yes.
And I think a lot of is like, on one hand, people are like, well, you can take up new hobbies or you can be extra productive or learn something you've always wanted to learn. But then on the other hand, it's like, it's okay to not be in the mood. It's okay to not get into it. It's okay because your brain is just, sometimes our brain goes kind of into survival mode and it doesn't necessarily feel relaxed enough to take up, you know, to try to be productive. Like some days it takes everything to just kind of like, you know, see what you have for the day, even if it's just mm-hmm. logging into your computer and checking your email. And, you know, even if it's something as simple as that, that would have been so mundane in other times. And now it's just, you know, it's like, but, you know, that's why I wish, like, when I talk to authors, especially, I feel so bad for authors who are, this is their debut novel releasing this year.
Yes.
And they have to do it so much differently and promote themselves and do all this, like, press and stuff like this so differently than how, you know, business is usually done. And mm-hmm. it's, you know, it's just the industry is like, all the industries are turned up on its head, but it's like for two, you know, some authors will work on their story for like 8 years and then this is the year that it's coming out. And then it's like, there's so many things without out their control. So, and I understand that's like one thing that's probably you had to deal with too, like compared releasing the sequel versus mm-hmm. releasing your first book. Cause the first book came out, was it last year or 2 years ago?
2 years ago.
Yeah. Okay. And so one of the things were a little more normal. And so was that like, how was it coping for you? Like you're comparing those two book releases and having to kind of do the whole round, maybe not necessarily of writing and publishing it or editing and publishing, but also doing the press and stuff like this.
I mean, I think there's a lot more where like I am doing a lot more interviews from home. So it's like a lot more of the evenings are taken up, you know, and I'm trying to do a lot more of the marketing on my own, you know, putting out these ads. And so I spend a lot of time creating different like pictures and things. And So yeah, it is, it's a lot. It's like a job in and of itself to market a book, and to do it during a pandemic is just twice as hard. Cause I mean, you want to be respectful of the fact that, you know, there are people out there, you know, like you said, who are losing their jobs or yeah. who are just struggling to get by. So it's hard to be like, hey, buy my great book. And I'm like, it's more important that you have food, you know,
yeah, or, exactly.
you know, things like that. So it is a weird place to be. And so, I'm just kind of going with the flow. Like if people buy it, that's awesome. And if now's not the time for them, then that's cool too, you know?
Yeah. And then you're hoping that you also can tap into your audience, your existing audience from the first book
yes.
who are waiting for your second book.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, they've been waiting a while because I had a book Tiger Queen come out in the middle.
Yeah, I noticed that. Why did you switch gears? I noticed that you had a book that was like released in between.
Yes. So Tiger Queen was already done. I had already written
okay.
it. And they were like, well, let's just get that one out because I still had to finish writing the sequel. So they're like, all right, well, we'll just release Tiger Queen then. And I was like, okay, sweet. I'll finish writing the sequel. So that's what I did. So it was a bit of an odd kind of timing thing that they did, but hopefully it'll work out and people will still be excited for the sequel. I mean, the cover is gorgeous. So I love the cover so much.
It is. So how much say did you have in that, in picking out the cover?
Like zero. It just showed up in my inbox. They're like, here's your cover. And I'm like, oh dear. Cause I can go like two ways, you know, like
sure.
really good or really, really bad. And I love it. I mean, it's got this beautiful crown on it. So I was
really and it happy. Ties really well in with yeah. the first one too.
Yeah, so they look really good. I'm like looking at them right now. My dad can't see them, but I can see them and they look really good. Yeah, I just got my author copies like a couple days ago. So
nice. Yeah, we're still, I keep forgetting that because I'm like, you know, we try to time these interviews to be released around the time that the book is released. It's so funny because it's like, oh no, I just got this a couple days ago. So I finally have physical copies. It was like, oh crap. Like, yeah, because it's totally, you know, it's almost time. You're in the final stretch.
So close, so close to release date. So I'm getting excited.
Yeah, I bet having the physical copy in front of you is like in your hand.
It's like, it, you know, a little bit more real.
Yeah, so. For sure. And like, oh, this is my baby and it's done and it's out and we're ready to yes. go. Like
kind
oh,
of a little bit of a relief. Like it's printed, it's going out there. We're good. Now I can focus on the new stuff. Maybe if I can get up the energy to work on it.
Right. No, exactly. Well, I think you've earned a little bit of a relaxation and a little bit of break, you know, and maybe, you know, cause I imagine things are going to be a little bit busy for you maybe for the next month as you're kind of like still in the honeymoon phase of releasing the sequel. So maybe towards the end of the year you can relax and then you'll remember that like, oh crap, yes, I have another project I want to get to.
Right, so. Right. Like, yeah, sometime I'll get back to it. Maybe I just need to tell myself I can't work on it for a couple weeks and then my brain will be like, well, we want to work on it. So maybe that'll be like my reverse psychology or something.
Maybe take a little bit of pressure off and then be like, no, wait, pressure's on now. Like, awesome. Well, thank you so much. And once again, for taking the time, Annie Sullivan, Curse of Gold comes out September 22nd. And A Touch of Gold is out now for those of you who want to catch up before releasing of the sequel. So yes, thank you so much. I had tons of fun rambling on about Cora and, you know, your experience and how you kind of imagined, you know, this female character who is unfortunately a consequence of her father's actions, but coming into her own and really hopefully, you know, becoming kind of some sort of inspiration for the age group that this book is intended for. So thank you so much. And I'm excited to get our audience out and help them. Hopefully this interview helps them dive in a little bit deeper too.
Thank you so much. Thank you for having me. This is amazing. I loved it.
Oh, so I'm glad. Me too. Thank you.
And thank you for listening to this episode of the Nerd Cantina Show. As always, we greatly appreciate the listen. And we ask that if you have a moment, please ensure that you've subscribed and give us a rating and review on your podcast player of choice. It goes a long way of helping us ensure that we grow this audience over time. And then if you enjoyed the conversation that took place there, you'll probably enjoy the conversations that are taking place over at thenerdcantina.com/community to join us at our Facebook group. We hope to see you there. And we hope you tune in next week for the next Nerd Cantina show where we recap the week's nerd news. All right, with all that said, talk to you again next week, nerds.